A Week in the Weege, a special.
We're sort of missing out half the story. And the assumption, of course, is that women didn't do very much. You know, they were in the home or whatever. But that's A, that's history too. And B, they did. You know, I found economists and scientists and writers.
A Week in the Weege, a special.
Hello and welcome to Week in the Weege. I'm Selena Jackson.
And I'm Natalie Crawford. And this week we are joined by Sarah Sheridan, author extraordinaire. Hello.
Hello.
Sarah is publishing a book this month where she has reimagined all of the landmarks, statues, streets in Scotland that are named after men and reimagined them as being named after women, which I just love.
Thank you. I love it too.
So where did this idea come from?
It came from an article in The New Yorker. So there's an American feminist writer called Rebecca Solnit who renamed all the stops on the New York subway after women. And I saw that article in The New Yorker had drawn a map and just got a bit ambitious with the idea because there's sort of 48 stops. On the New York subway and thought, no. What we need to do is the entire country. Yeah. So away I went.
Amazing.
How long did it take you, first of all, just to go through the whole of the country and pick out all these landmarks, never mind finding the women that you were going to rename them after?
Well, I started with the women, actually, rather than with the landmarks. So I am a historical novelist to trade, so I'm used to doing big research projects, but it was a doozy of a big research project. So I got my specs on, eyes down, and sorted through the biographies of around maybe 5,000 to 6,000 Scottish women.
Wow.
And chose about 1,000 that I thought were a really good mix, different people doing different things that were interesting. I was kind of shocked and horrified about how many I hadn't heard of before, because it's my field, so I was kind of interested in it. And I was finding these women thinking, how do I not know about you? Whose granny are you? You know?
Yeah.
And then got a map and thought, well, where am I going to put them all? And what kind of monument would really suit them? Because, you know, a lot of our memorial culture are street names and statues, and that's very Victorian, maybe Edwardian. But there are a lot of brilliant ways to memorialise people, and perhaps more creatively than just a big brass person. So big brass people have their places, and in our central squares or big streets sometimes in cities, that's where they belong. But I wanted to do things with light shows and lectures and bells and all kinds of exciting other ideas. And we have an amazing landscape. You know, we have urban landscapes and we have some of the most incredible rural landscapes in the world. So there are lots of places where you thought, you know, why have we got an old man of Hoy? Maybe we should have an old woman of Hoy.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely
a good idea.
Because it's interesting what you were saying about being a historian and going through and being shocked at the amount of women that you hadn't heard of. I think in your introduction you say that less than 0.5% of all recorded history is dedicated to women, or something like that.
Or it comes from women's material. So Bettany Hughes, who's an amazing historian, did a study in 2016, and that's what she came up with. 0.5% of recorded history is female history. So we're sort of missing out half the story. Mm-hmm. And the assumption, of course, is that women didn't do very much. You know, they were in the home or whatever. But that's A, that's history too. Mm-hmm. And B, they did. You know, I found economists and scientists and writers, women who actually achieved a lot in their own era, and perhaps we're very famous in the Roman eras, and part of our culture is to forget women much more quickly perhaps than we forget the achievements of men. And so that was kind of really interesting, because as a novelist I'd worked researching particular stories before, and with a novel you go into everything. You know, you go into what you had for breakfast and what kind of pants they wore and how long it took to get from one thing to another, and you know everything about that person by the time you're writing the book about them. But with this it was really interesting because it was such a broad landscape. I'd picked women from prehistory and mythical women, medieval women, and just seeing those generations thinking, oh my goodness, you know, we have this incredible culture. Our grannies and great grannies and great great grannies were amazing, and particularly they stood up for what they believed in. You know, we have a lot of activists, we have a lot of political activists as well as economic activists, we had economists, we had all sorts of stuff that I just hadn't realised, generation after generation after generation. So that was amazing to realise that that's kind of what we come from.
And of course, they're the women that have sort of shaped the world that we live in today and paved the women for paved the way for women today. So, yeah. I mean, were there many that perhaps you hadn't even heard of before? And once you started looking into them, you thought,
totally,
that's
it was
amazing.
Horrifying how many I hadn't heard of. And actually, there's a whole lot of Victorian women who were going out being thinking that they were the first in their field. And actually, there were medieval women who had done that stuff. Mm-hmm. But because the medieval women had been forgotten, the Victorian women thought they were the first. Yeah. I thought, well, how much more difficult is that then to achieve if you think you're the first all the time? Mm-hmm. You know, two generations, you've got to be the first again. Mm-hmm. And so I found like medieval tax collectors in Dundee. I found an amazing woman called Rose Blaise de Bury, who was born in Oban and who... wrote in the 1850s an economic policy for Austria.
Oh, wow.
Like, why had I not heard of Rose Blaise de Bury, who like had correspondence with Bismarck? Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. I found Dorothy Stevenson, cousin of Robert Louis Stevenson, mm-hmm. who sold 40 million copies of her books in her lifetime.
Wow.
I was completely forgotten. You know, there's statues to Robert Louis all over the place. She outsold him, mm-hmm. you know,
and
her books are very different from his, but they're great. And so, you know, the title of this book is Where Are the Women? And this is what I kept coming, every time I was reading something, I was like, where are the women? Why are they not here? Like, how have we managed to do this? And actually, I think the way we have done it is, there's been a kind of long-term kind of feeling that you don't want to show off if you're a woman. You don't want to blow your own trumpet. And so people didn't. And so they have very much been forgotten.
Yeah. Well, there's that old saying, isn't there, that history is written by the victors.
Mm.
So... If women aren't, you know, men are seen to be the victors in every situation, they're never going to get the opportunity to
tell their own side.
And so our history's really skewed. I mean, someone said to me, "Oh, you're really revisionist," and I was like, "This needs revising," you know, because and not just for the women, also for the men. You know, that puts a lot of pressure on men. You don't have to do that. There's the other 50% of the population that's also creating great stuff, and so it's really about. The book's a bit of a provocation because I have taken out all the men. and in my ideal world, you know, that actually doesn't happen. But what I hope is people will read the book, go out into the street and think, actually, what we've got is quite weird, because having it with all women is quite weird. But also what we've really got in real life is even weirder.
Well, that's the thing. It's not about kind of erasing the men, but it's about finding a way of knitting the two of them together and remembering all of these people that did amazing things, regardless
and
of whether
they
male
each
or
other.
Female.
Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, Sir Walter Scott or Robert Burns, you know, they were supported by women who were also in their field, and they in their turn supported those women. In fact, particularly Walter Scott was a real ally to a lot of female writers. And so it's representing their world as it really was, I suppose.
So once you had the women, how did you then go about deciding who was going to be assigned to where and what?
Well, it's really their story. I mean, what kind of monuments? So there's lots of different kinds of monuments in there. So there's individual monuments to women. So where were they born, or where were they educated, or, you know, did they achieve something that was in a particular place, and finding something that really chimed with them. So some of the big guns, for example, Wilhelmina Fleming, who was an amazing astrologer, born in Dundee, went to America, discovered like hundreds of stars and all kinds of stuff. You know, I gave her an observatory on the big hill in Dundee. So finding something like that, we think, yeah. And then just crazy ones, like I put up a monument in Stranraer to a woman called Margaret Skinner, who fought under Countess Markovitch during the fight for the Irish Free State. And she kept getting caught in Ireland, and she had a broad Glasgow accent, sent back to Glasgow, and she would go back over. And when she went back over, it was Edwardian times, and so she had these like big Edwardian hats, you know, those hats women wore, and she used to smuggle detonators in her hats. So there'd be hats with all these flowers and stuff on them, and she had detonators in, taking them over for the cause. So those kind of women, you know, a lot of big personalities, people who were doing things, and, you know, all different kinds. You don't have to agree with them. You know, there were people of all different political persuasions, all different classes, trying to really give a flavour, actually, of you know, where we come from.
So obviously we're based in Glasgow. So talk me around, if you can, some of the notable women in Glasgow and what you kind of gave them.
Well, there are loads, actually. I think one of the things that I didn't realise when I started researching the book was that individual places, because of that, social positions or economic positions, produce individual kinds of women. So in Glasgow, there's a lot of activists. So you've got your Mary Barbers, but also a lot of suffragettes. So, for example, I took down all the statues in George Square, and put up in that big central plinth a suffragette called Eunice Murray. And people said if when they heard Eunice speak about the suffrage for women, you know, she was so convincing. There was no way you could hear Eunice speak and not be converted to the cause. She was an amazing public speaker and actually went on to be an activist after women gained the vote for other equality causes. There's a woman in Glasgow that I discovered had come to Glasgow. She's a black woman, had come from the West Indies. Her name was Doll. And she was very wealthy. She was a free black woman, brought some of her grandchildren and children to be educated in Scotland. And she arrived in Glasgow in the early 19th century and caused an absolute stir, complete riot. And I wanted to put something up to her because we have that connection in Glasgow, you know, to that colonial trade. Mm-hmm. And she was a woman who'd really bucked that. In fact, she had a couple of white son-in-laws and she lent them money when their businesses went down because she, you know, she was so rich. Mm-hmm. She had made so much money. And then women like Bebe Broun, who was an early Hollywood, was active in early Hollywood. She was a stunt woman and she was also the leg double for Marlene Dietrich. So Marlene Dietrich apparently raging that they didn't want to use her legs. They preferred Baby's legs. And Baby also got talked by Hitchcock into doing some fairly daring stunts. She ended up in terrible cold water for a long time and I think ended up with pneumonia at one stage from doing stunts in early Hollywood. So there's a lot to be proud of. And just imprinting that on the landscape. So, for example, one of the things that I decided to do was hang a big screen off the Finiston Crane. And then in the summertime, project footage of Glasgow's amazing women onto that screen. Mm. So it's like making it really visible because one of the issues we have when we do put up monuments to women is they tend to be at the back, they're at the side, they're in a, you know, our central space is already taken up by the men. There's no room left. Mm. And so I wanted to bring women back into that sort of central square, like Eunice and George Square, or, you know, really put them in the main places.
Mm. How... What am I trying to say? I don't know. How likely do you think it is that something like this will make a difference and help make a dent in, you know, changing that landscape and starting to introduce, you know, monuments to women? Because another thing that really struck me in your introduction was when you said there's only 15% of statues in the UK are actually dedicated to women, and most of them are to Queen Victoria.
Now, she loved a statue, Victoria.
She was a wonderful woman, and she hasn't a whole era named after her, but she's not the only woman successful.
Yeah, well, I think it's about just making that argument in the book. I mean, it's very brave of Historic Environment Scotland who are publishing the book, and they have actually commissioned maps with some in the book of some of these monuments, you know, showing where they would be. And I suppose the first thing you have to do is be able to imagine it. You know, if you can't dream it, you can't build it. And I would really hope that people would look at this because it's not, you know, statues are very expensive once you start into that. But there are a lot of things in the book that could be done with very little money. And this is all also legislated at local levels. So this is something that local councils can look at and say, well, actually, we've got all these women who are connected to our area and we could do flower beds to them. We could put up a bench. We can have a, you know, it's not, it doesn't have to be the, you know, £50,000 statue. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It can be done within, you know, a much tighter budget. Although I think we need some statues. I think Eunice should definitely be, you know, on top of that column. So I suppose we have to see, because I'm a novelist, so it's my job to dream it. It's my job to think it and to sort of... to come up with those ideas. It's not really my job to do it because sadly I'm not in charge.
It would be good if we were though, wouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, lovely, wouldn't it?
I mean, and I think actually even if all it does is that some people read this book and think, oh my God, I come from something amazing. Mm. Why can't I do something amazing? And that's the real tragedy. It's something that Solnit said in her original essay in The New Yorker is, you know, what would it be like to grow up in a world where the streets were named after women, where the whole world is gendered to include you? Mm-hmm. That's an amazing feeling for a young person that, you know, oh, there's a huge statue to a female scientist. It's possible to be a female scientist and actually to win at that, to win to the degree that you're memorialised 100 years, 200 years, whatever it is after your death. So,
well, that's just what I was about to ask, actually. How important is it to have these women visible and memorialised for perhaps young girls growing up in Glasgow? And I'm not sure if you'll have spoken to people that say, do you know, because you're not seeing these names, you're not seeing these women, it seems as though it's a narrative that just excludes you and that you couldn't break into.
Totally.
Is that something that you've experienced? Do you think it would make a genuine difference to young girls and, I mean, young boys as well growing up,
yeah,
and just seeing this good balance and thinking, yeah, okay, this is an open playing field.
This is the real world.
Yeah.
This is the real world, and we've been living in a highly edited world. So, yeah, I think it is really important. And I think there's that thing that, you know, I'm a mother, and I have a mother, as we all do.
Yeah.
This is something we all have in common. So I look at my family and I think, you know, I look at what I've learned during the course of writing this book about, say, the suffragettes, and I think my great-granny, who supported Votes for Women,
mm-hmm.
I think, oh, my God, she changed the world for me. And what my mother did with that kind of early feminism, you know, it's very different from feminism mm-hmm. today, that early feminism where, you know, you burnt your bra and said you thought the pill was a good idea. Like, it's a low bar these days. But you know, we might not even call that person a feminist these days. But my mother did that. You know, my mother did that for me. And that, and it really makes you think, well, actually, what am I going to do mm-hmm. for my daughter mm-hmm. and my goddaughters, you know, any generations after that? Or actually, my, you know, I don't have a son, but I have nephews, for example, as you say, it's really important. But also there's a sense in which I don't think I could have written this book without being dragged on by those future generations. So that generation ahead of you have a part to play. And my mother is still a very old-fashioned feminist. You know, she doesn't get the trans debate. She's, mm-hmm. you know, that is beyond her. She's in her 80s. And I'm very lucky in that my kid, Molly, and my godchildren as well are very much sort of bringing that, you know, updating my feminism mm-hmm. as I go along. And so there's that really real sense of the continuum that you've got stuff that you can do for the next generation. But actually the next generation need to pull us on as well. And that's something that you see with a lot of this sort of environmental debate that's mm-hmm. going on, actually. Mm-hmm. Young people leading the way. And that's hugely valuable.
Mm-hmm. And I think as well, we've obviously seen quite a big cultural shift in the last kind of few years, maybe a few decades as well, where feminism is now becoming cool. You know, yeah. I think before feminism was quite taboo and people were, it was kind of dismissed.
It was a dirty word.
Ah, and people were, oh.
I have always been, I have to say, I have always been a big dirty feminist. and worse than smelly, you know, my daughter and I run a perfume company called Reek.
Mm-hmm.
And at Reek, we mix perfumes that memorialise amazing Scottish women. So
oh,
we have
really?
A perfume called Damn Rebel Bitches, which was what the Hanoverian press called mm-hmm. the Jacobite women.
Yep.
And we have a perfume about the witches as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we are unashamedly smelly feminists. and the purpose of that company is to create a connection with women now to women to the past,
mm-hmm.
but also that any woman can be a memorial.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you put on that perfume and you remember the amazing Jacobite women mm-hmm. like Flora MacDonald or Anne McIntosh, or and they're in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings me to another point, because we've talked about individual monuments, but actually also another thing that I felt was really important to memorialise are group monuments.
Mm.
So after the Jacobite uprising in 46, the Redcoats came into Scotland and they were basically trying to suppress everyone. They killed the cattle and they burnt down people's crofts and they raped the women. There was a kind of a directive, and it's something that's used in wars today, that kind of physical violence against women. And so I went to a historian I know and I said, you know, how many women do you think were raped? And he said, oh, well, you know, four Highland counties in the 1740s, there was probably 160,000 women living then. If you cut out the very young and the very old, you know, to achieve that today, if you're looking at places that happen, say in Africa, where they would go in and rape women to subdue the population, it's about 10%. So that's 16,000 Gaelic-speaking women in the 1740s. Potentially, we don't know because there's no records of it. You know, it's no rape crisis centre.
Mm-hmm.
And these are Gaelic-speaking women, so it's not written down. It's not, you know, and they're ashamed of it.
Yeah.
They're largely Catholic. They're really ashamed of it.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't talk about it. And so I think those kind of monuments are really important culturally as well. And those women, those Jacobite women who stood up for their cause, didn't fight for what they believed in, but certainly were in the background there and supporting it, they're... daughters became involved in the Highland clearances, their granddaughters became involved in the rent strike, the suffrage movement, the struggle for women's education. We have generations of amazing grandparents, you know,
yeah.
and we don't know it.
Mm-hmm. And do you think there's kind of more of a acceptance towards people actually learning these stories now, and because it is so much now in the public domain and you're starting to hear more of women's stories, do you think it's something that people would perhaps now, maybe more than previously, be very interested to hear about and think, actually, yeah, this
like
is right, we should be hearing this.
Go to yeah. seek out
I
this
hope
information.
So, let's see. I mean, I find it fascinating, but I've always been, you know, really interested in women's history. It's my kind of thing. I've been writing about it in terms of novels and stuff for years. So, but I suppose we're going to see.
Yeah. So how, I mean, this just sounds like an absolutely massive undertaking. talk me through the process. How long did it take you?
I'd written a book, or I'd written a short story for a book called Bloody Scotland, same publisher. And as part of that, I had been in some historic environment Scotland properties and had gone back to the publisher and said, well, you've not got many women in these properties. And we talked about this project, this Rebecca Solnit project, which Jamie, the publisher, had seen as well, so he knew. And it was him that actually said, why don't you do the whole country? And I was like, oh my God, yes. It's like that thing of like, oh my God, can I actually do this? And then it was like, I'm going to do it.
So daunting, but also an incredible challenge.
Like, so yep, that coffee was in February last year.
Okay.
And then I handed in the first draft in August. So there was no sleep. Like February to August.
That's only what, six it was, months or something months like that?
It was it was really intense. It was kind of the only way to do it. And then there was a long editing process where the editor that I was assigned, called Christine, at Historic Environment Scotland, was amazing, because once you've had that kind of imaginative engagement with something, you're a bit mad. You know, writers have this reputation for being a bit mad. And it's true, because once you've done that, you're a bit kind of off your face with it. It's like it's quite strong magic. And so she was really great coming back to me and saying, okay, I think we need a little bit more about this woman, maybe a little bit less about this woman, Zara. And just kind of helping to get the tone of it right. And we probably edited for back and forward for about 3 months, all the different sections. And then they commissioned Jenny Proudfoot, who's an amazing illustrator, to make some maps for the book.
And how was that scene, what you had imagined and pictured in your head, coming to life in an illustration?
It was amazing. I mean, I have got a children's book out this year, actually, that I wrote with my daughter, which is all about Nessie. It's called Monsters Unite. And so I'm used to working with illustrators. And actually, that was a Glasgow illustrator that illustrated that book, a guy called Ian Carroll, who's kind of really into monsters. He sometimes branches out into dinosaurs, but really he likes monsters. And so I'd had that process before of telling a story that I had to go alongside. But it was great, because I don't know quite how to put this. She was really good at making it visually work. Do you know what I mean? Because, you know, I had imagined stuff, but that didn't mean I'd visually imagined it. I was like, wouldn't it be great if there was a whole lot of stars that went off in the sky to commemorate the witches? that's a good idea. I've just written it down.
Just make a constellation.
Yeah, what we need is this sort of thing. So she was great, because she was like, I'm going to illustrate that one, but maybe not that one. So that was quite an interesting sort of process. And it's really beautiful to see. Like, I like her illustrative work, I like her style, so it's kind of a bit of an honour, really, to have them go to the trouble of making maps, which are at the beginning of each section. And they haven't illustrated all of them, because there are, you know, over 1,000 monuments. And just to be specific about Glasgow, when I started to write the book, there were 5 statues to women in Glasgow, one Victoria. And by the time I'd finished, there were 7. And in the book, there's 172.
Wow.
So that's, you know, we're still at a very low end of the bar. I mean, I know, as I was writing the book, the statue to Mary Barber and the Renstrike women was unveiled, and everyone was all, this is amazing, we've made it. We are nowhere near making it. You know, we're well far off making it.
By comparison, do you know how many statues there are of men in Glasgow?
I don't actually. Someone should count that.
Well, I mean, the rest of them in... you only need to walk down a street in Glasgow and there's a statue at the end of it. They're in almost
and the street's
every
often
street
named
corner.
After a man. I mean, I found myself raging. I live in the West End of Edinburgh, and so I'm wandering about the West End of Edinburgh down Walker Street, named after Robert Walker, thinking, what about Mary and Barbara?
Yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely. God, only 7? Wow.
I mean, those are actual statues. Yeah. But yeah, it's crazy.
But when you think it... They are almost at the end of every street corner in Glasgow. You turn around and there's something else, and there's...
Listen, you're doing better than Edinburgh. There's 3 in central Edinburgh.
Oh, my goodness.
A Victoria and 2 Mary Queen of Scots. Like, it is woeful. Really, really woeful.
So what are some of your highlights from the book then? Some of your favourite women that you didn't know existed before you started out?
Well, I am a writer, so there's some writers that really struck a chord with me. Mary Brunton, who came from Barra, eloped with her husband, who was a minister, and he took a job at the University of Edinburgh, and she wrote two novels and was in the middle of her third novel when she died in the early 18th century in childbirth. And her novels were massively successful, like absolutely huge, translated into French, and her second novel inspired Jane Austen to write Emma.
Wow.
So it's kind of a pre-Emma, Emma.
Yeah.
And she's buried in the Canongate Kirk, and there is a plaque to her and her husband, the same plaque. But there's nothing to Mary. So definitely she would be one of the ones I'm like, what are we doing? Not memorialising that. I suppose who else are among my favourites? I think I kind of like the Dundee women. You know, some of the Dundee women. Dundee had the first maidservant strike in the UK. I mean, anywhere. There was a lot of strong Dundee women, so I kind of liked the fact that Dundee produced some female engineers and a whole crop of kind of late 18th century working class poets, female poets. I think in terms of large monuments to groups of women, my favourite one probably is the one that I made up to the Highland Clearance Women. So and it's based on a monument that exists in Germany, not to the Highland Clearance Women, but for something else. And it's a massive piece of stone, like absolutely huge, the size of a building. And underneath it are the villages, the names of the cross and the villages that exist. And it's placed in boggy ground so it can sink into the ground along with the memory of these women. And so that, I think, was one of my favourite ones, just because it's so monumental. And the Highlands was great for that. I put a lot of these monuments, these kind of monuments in the Highlands, just because they can become part of the landscape in a totally sort of unique way.
Yeah. So anybody who is picking this book up has to come at it with a bit of imagination and a bit of an open mind. What would you say to anybody that was picking it up and cracking the cover for the first time?
I'd say don't read all of it at once. It's a guidebook. And it reads like a guidebook. You'd never sit down to read the whole of the rough guide. So go to some places maybe that you know and discover the women that and their stories from that place. And then, you know, maybe branch out from that. I think that's what I do. I remember when because I live in Edinburgh, the first section I wrote was Edinburgh. And I phoned Jamie up after I'd written Edinburgh. I was like, it's really dense. And then he was like, as dense as the rough guide. And I was like, maybe not as dense as the rough guide, but close to that. So. And that was a conscious decision. I could have decided they would have let me just pick 50 women. And I was like, no way. If we're going to do this,
we're going to do it properly.
We need the volume, because that's the shocking thing, is like page after page, after street, after hill, after everything, you know, we have thousands and thousands of these amazing women. And I've been very privileged in the last few weeks. I've met some people whose grannies and great grannies are memorialised in the book. Unexpectedly, I just ended up speaking to this girl at an event, and I was telling her about the book, and she was like, oh, my granny was a writer. And I was like, oh, what's her name? And she told me, and I said, oh, she's in the book. And she was like, oh, but, you know, she just, you know, she was big in America, but she didn't do much here. And I was like, well, your granny cracked the biggest, most difficult market in the world, and you're just talking that down right there. What's going on? And she was like, I write enough. And I was like, well, you just got to stop doing that.
Yeah, what chance she got. So did you get the opportunity to visit many of these places and visualise yourself, you know, where you were putting these monuments?
Yeah, some of them. I mean, not all of them, but some of them. And it's the longest acknowledgements, actually, that I've ever written for a book, was writing the acknowledgements for this book. Because once I had said I was doing it, people were just so helpful and so supportive. And I wanted to try and sort of get all of them in the acknowledgements. So there's pages of it, of people who came up with ideas or came back to me about information, or I did a couple of shout outs even on Twitter, said, you know, who do you think are the most amazing women? So people coming back with, you know, their picks. People in specific locations. So being able to phone up, for example, curators in museums that I wasn't able to visit that area and say to them, look, who is in your area? What have you got in your collection? Even if it's not on display. I mean, of that, when we're talking about, you know, the Bettany Hughes 0.5%, you know, a lot of that is in archive. So that's not 0.5% of what's on display. That's 0.5% of what's in the basement, you know, so as well. So it was quite exciting, I think, or I hope it was quite exciting and not just a pain in the ass for them to have somebody phone up and say, well, actually, what have you got that you're not putting on display about the women in your area?
Thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Where Are All the Women, published by Historic Environments Scotland, written by the lovely Sarah Sheridan, out next week.
Hurrah!
Yay!
A Week in the Weege is a Radio Clyde News production. For the latest around the clock, follow on Twitter at Radio Clyde News.